This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Joe Engel ministers to a congregation of the condemned, the inmates on death row. Engel is a minister in the United Church of Christ and director of the Southern Coalition on Jails and Prisons. He was twice nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize for his work opposing the death penalty. His new book, Last Rites, is about his work with 12 men and one woman who he came to know well before they were executed. Engel first wondered what life was like in prison back in 1971 when he watched the TV reports on the Attica uprising. After that, he decided to work with prisoners in the Bronx House of Detention for his 9-month seminary project. It convinced him he should be working in prison ministry. He says when the death penalty was reinstated in 1976, he thought about what it meant to be a Christian in a country determined to legally kill people. He's worked with death row prisoners ever since, primarily in prisons throughout the South. I asked Engel how much access to death row inmates prison authorities allow him. Since he's not a prison chaplain, he works independently.
I have quite a bit of access, but it's not always due to the fact that I'm a minister. One of the ironies of the death penalty is that those of us who are in the clergy and who believe that our God would have us working against the death penalty are sometimes obstructed by the state chaplains who actually work in the prisons themselves and are paid by the state. The reason for that is these gentlemen are paid by the state and they have to answer to the warden, so the death row prisoners, for instance, don't usually confide in them, and they see some of us from the outside as threats. Now, that's an overgeneralization. In some instances, we've had a lot of cooperation, but very often when I visit a death row in a southern state, and I visit them all, I go through the warden's office, not the chaplain's office, because I have a whole lot better success dealing with wardens than I do chaplains.
Are there any restrictions that are placed on you? Are there any, for instance, right before the execution, can you be there as a minister of choice, or does it have to be the prison chaplain who spends those last minutes with the prisoner?
Well, as you can appreciate, since we started this work in 1977 with the first execution in Utah and then John Spinklink in 1979, the prison officials, have, like us, none of us knew what we were doing. We've had to evolve rules as we go, so we've had a lot of disagreements and arguments, but pretty much now, I can, as a minister, get in, and indeed, I was with Willie Darden when the state of Florida prepared him for killing on March 15th, 1988, and then strapped him in the electric chair. And this morning, I received a letter from a dear friend of mine on death row in Florida who wants me to be with him when he fears he's going to be executed probably this fall. So I can be there with them as a minister. It's their choice.
But you don't usually go to the executions.
Well, I've had a rule up to Willie that I would not witness any of my friends being killed. I thought that was just too much. If you're going to work with people on death row and you learn to care for them and they for you and you love them and they love you, and to watch them strapped into a killing device and slaughtered is just a little much. But that night I was there at the Florida State Prison and Willie asked me to be there for him when he was killed, and I couldn't say no. I'd known Willie for over 10 years. We were very close. He was innocent. We'd done everything we could, so I was there that morning for Willie, and we always try to have someone in the death chamber who loves the person who's being killed so that when they're killed, they're looking at someone who loves and cares for them and has worked for them, just not just official functionaries.
What kind of visual communication did you and Willie Darden have with each other in those last moments of his life?
Oh, gee, Terry, this is quite painful, so you have to give me a minute here. Willie and I had talked about this. I was outside of his cell from about 1 a.m. till 5:30, and we had discussed what he wanted me to do. So when they loaded us all in the prison van and took us down to Q-Wing, where the death chamber is, and we walked into the room, I stood in the back so Willie could see me, and I wear a symbol around my neck, which is a gold symbol with a cross and over a circle and the equal marks in the circle. It's all are equal in the world under the cross. It's a symbol of the Committee of Southern Churchmen, and it's something Willie and I believed in. And so Willie wanted me to be there when they let him into the death chair holding the symbol so he could see me. So at 7 o'clock, the rear door to the death chamber opened, and they escorted Willie in. He was, of course, manacled. His hands were handcuffed and manacled to his waist. His ankles were also hobbled, and they led him over to the chair, and sat him down and removed the chains and then strapped him in and put a microphone in front of his face and asked him if he wanted to make a last statement. And he did, and he gave a very eloquent testimony to the fact that the state of Florida was executing an innocent man, that he had maintained his innocence from the beginning, and it had been over 14 years, and he was still innocent. And then he went on to thank those who had worked for his behalf and done everything they could for him, and mentioned some of us by name, and then said he bore no ill will toward anyone and wished that God bless us all. And at that point, he had already made eye contact with me before the statement. And when he was finished the statement, one of the guards put a hand to his chin and shoved his chin back against the headrest on the chair, and it winced. He winced. It hurt him. And he immediately looked at me and winked to let me know he was okay. And then they strapped the leather strap around his chin and put the death mask on his face and attached the cap to his head, and they'd already put the electrode on his left leg. And once they dropped that shroud over the face, they're ready to kill him. So Willie, even though his arms were strapped down, lifted his left wrist and waved with his hand and waved goodbye to me, and then they killed him.
Did you avert your eyes at the time of death?
Well, you know, once they dropped that shroud over Willie's face and he could not see me, I dropped my head in prayer because I had to get through this. And I prayed for Willie, and I prayed for myself, and I prayed for everyone who'd worked so hard to keep him alive, and I prayed for his wife, Felicia. I just prayed nonstop. As the book of Ephesians said, I prayed without ceasing. It's the only thing I knew to do to get through that moment.
Joseph Engel is my guest, and he ministers to people on death row, and his new book is called Last Rites. You don't believe in the death penalty. I wonder how you prepare people for a death that you don't believe in.
Well, we all die. I'm not preparing people to die. We're talking about killing people here. That's why I don't even like the term death penalty, and why I'm suggesting we use another term, what I call it's an administrative massacre, really, or an administrative slaughter. I don't go in there to prepare anybody for anything. These folks are friends of mine. I don't want people to think I'm riding in on a white horse and here I am preparing people at the last minute as they're killed. Nothing could be further from the truth. Folks on death row, without exception, do more ministering to me than I ever do to them. And anyone who goes into a death row will tell you that. It's an extraordinary experience. We have human beings in cages under conditions you could not possibly imagine. We feed them in their cells. We treat them worse than animals. And yet somehow they're able to triumph. The human spirit triumphs through all this, and friendships grow, and people change. And then you place them in a situation of incredible pressure where they're about to be killed. And under this torturous ordeal, somehow the grace of the Holy Spirit or whatever it is comes to the fore, and we see again and again these folks coming out of themselves and reaching out to people around them and ministering to people who love them and caring for them and being more concerned about the damage that their killing is going to have on their family and on those who've worked for them than what it's going to do to them. It's absolutely extraordinary, and perhaps some psychologist someday or some wise person can explain all this to me. All I do is I'm just there, and I'm a friend, and I try to help out.
Do you often ask the people on death row who you're close to who are about to be executed if there's anything that you can do for them after their death?
Oh, sure. Simple things like writing letters to people. You know, they don't always have time to write letters to everybody they want to write them to. Make sure family members getting certain mementos of their possessions, what few they have. And, you know, make sure that the state doesn't bury him. I mean, it seems like a simple thing, but the state wants to bury him on the prison grounds, so we don't want that to happen, so we usually end up having to help the family raise money to bury them in a place with dignity. So it's those kind of things that you have to deal with.
When you make the rounds on death row, do the men and women you talk to, do you feel that they have to accept Christ, or can they just accept your friendship?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, I don't worry about people accepting Christ. I mean, my whole theology is that Jesus has accepted us, and that's the basic point. I'm not out here to win souls for anybody. I think Jesus takes care of all that. I'm there simply, the theologian Kierkegaard talked about the method of indirection, and he thought that was the best way to communicate the gospel, and I think he's absolutely right. I walk in there and visit people. I don't talk about religion. I'm not there to talk about religion. I'm talking about there to keep them alive and to help them in any way I can. And then if some way on down the line they get interested in why on earth I'm coming in here to help them, they might ask me. And if they ask me, then I tell them, well, I believe as a Christian that this is absolutely immoral and we shouldn't be doing this, and I'm going to do everything I can to keep it from happening to you. So that's the way I get into the whole religion thing, if they want to do it. But it's only if they bring it up that I even talk about it.
You get very close with a lot of the inmates on death row who you work with. Now, I mean, most, you know, they're convicted of murder and you know, of terrible crimes. Are you ever frightened about what kind of people they really are?
Oh, no. I mean, I think that's part of the whole myth of who's on death row. They're some kind of monsters. Nothing could be further from the truth. They're ordinary folks like you and I, except for two things. Granted, they are convicted of committing a murder, but what sends them to death row is not necessarily committing the murder. We have 20,000 murders in this country a year. Of those 20,000, about 250 go to death row. Now, those 250 are characterized by two factors. One, they're all poor. 9 out of 10 folks who are on death row in this country could not afford a lawyer. And believe me, you buy justice in this country. And if you can't afford a lawyer and you're facing a first-degree murder charge, then that's a ticket to death row. And the second factor is almost everyone's killed a white person. Now, that's the way we function with the death penalty in this country. And historically, that's the way we function since 1608. It's discrimination on race of victim. We very rarely send someone to death row for killing a black person. So those are the two things, and that doesn't have anything to do with the person's personality or somebody being difficult to deal with. Quite the contrary, most wardens will be the first ones to tell you that people who commit murder are the easiest people to deal with in their prison population. And that's because people who commit murder are not proud of what they've done. They're not proud at all. That's why it's the least repeated crime in the United States. In reality, most murderers are simply not likely to ever do the crime again, whether we put them in prison or not, much less kill them.
You must have, in addition to the people who you speak really highly of, you must have met some pretty unsavory characters on death row. Do you feel like you work equally hard for a stay of execution for someone who you really feel warmly towards as you do for someone who you don't much like, but you would still defend their right to live and not be executed?
Well, you need to understand something, and that is this. Augustine put it best. You hate the sin. You hate the act of what someone does, in this case, murder. God knows I hate murder, whether it's on the street corner or whether it's in a death chamber. I'm opposed to it. But Augustine also said this. He said, you love the sinner. And this is something we've lost in our society. You know, people can do awful things and still be human beings and still be worthy of love. You know, they still have mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and children who love them no matter what they've done. I mean, if it's your daughter or your son, do you want that person in an electric chair? Of course not. So I haven't met anyone on death row, and I've met people who've done awful things, terrible things, who I'm afraid of or who I think is what you would call an unsavory character. I haven't met a single unsavory character. I have met people who've done horrible deeds, but that does not define who they are. They are human beings like you and I, Terry. They're just not people who've done unsavory things.
Did you ever feel that you were being used or manipulated by someone, that you were being played for a sucker?
No, really. I mean, the only time, you know, in the early days, I had to work so hard to get in to see these people. The prison authorities didn't want me and my colleagues in the prisons to start with. But once we got in, it was very clear that, you know, we're about the only thread these folks had, one of the few threads they had. So the last thing we have to worry about being is manipulated. They want to work with us and do whatever they can to help, not only themselves, but each other and their families, because they realize what's going on. You know, we've got people penned up like cattle. We're leading them down the chute, and one by one, we're slaughtering them. And they certainly want all the help they can get in that process. They're not interested in manipulating it. Besides, how can they manipulate it? Lord, they're in such bad shape themselves in terms of conditions that they really can't manipulate anybody.
Do you ever run into suspicion of do-gooders?
No. The people who think that you're a do-gooder usually think that for a little while, but when you keep doing something for 15 years, they realize there must be something more to it than that.
Well, do they know that you've been at it for 15 years?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everybody on death row knows who I am. We've got a newsletter that goes out to everybody on death row. We work very closely with people on death row. We want them to submit articles to the newsletter, so they know who we are and what we stand for.
Joe Engel is my guest, and he ministers to people on death row. He's written a new book about that called Last Rites. You've fought often to get stays of execution from governors, from the president. Were you ever successful?
Yes. I had a meeting with Governor Edwards along with Congressman John Conyers and a couple other folks for Willie Watson, a man who's on death row in Louisiana, and went to the governor's mansion at midnight, and the execution was, we were actually there at 9 o'clock. The governor kept us waiting for 2.5 hours. The execution was set for a little after midnight, so we're having this very intense conversation with the governor. The clock's ticking away in the governor's mansion, and they're going to kill Willie a little after midnight. And finally, the governor stood up and walked away and said he had to make a telephone call. And we're sitting here. We don't know what's going on. He's going to make a telephone call, and he comes back and tells us he stopped the execution. That's why he considers what we've had to say to him. And being the gracious southerner he is, he invites us to stay in the mansion for the night. But I knew where that was going, so I said, no thanks. We went back to the hotel, and sure enough, 4 hours later, he lifted the stay, and they stripped Willie Watson into the electric chair and killed him. There are other people like Joseph Green Brown, who's totally innocent, who got off after 14 years on death row in Florida. There are also innocent people in this book. Tim Baldwin, Willie Darden, James Adams are all electrocuted. The folks in the book are people I've worked with who've been killed by the state. I have worked with some others who have had better fates than that.
There's an expression that there's no guilty men in prison. I mean, so many prisoners will tell you that they're innocent even when they are guilty. Do you usually accept people on their word when they tell you that they're innocent?
Well, sure, you accept them on their word, but you're no fool. You know, you look at the legal brief, you look at the legal record, you see what's going on, because if you're going to really help the person, you have to know the facts. So you educate yourself about the person's legal case and whether or not they're telling you the truth. They're not telling you the truth. You let them know in short order that you know what the case is.
What would you recommend for people who've committed murder who are now on death row? What do you think the alternative should be?
Well, we ran a poll about this, Terry, because, you know, you keep reading about 80% of the American people are for the death penalty. And we chose the state of Georgia because the state of Georgia has executed more people in this century than any other state in the United States. And so we ran a poll, and we asked several questions, one of which was, well, are you for the death penalty for the mentally retarded? Well, 66% of Georgians said absolutely not. Well, they had actually executed Jerome Bowden down there, who was mentally retarded. So with our poll and with that execution, we were able to get the Georgia General Assembly to pass legislation to prevent execution of the mentally retarded. Second aspect of the poll was, how about juveniles? You want to execute juveniles, children, when they commit murder, people under 18. Well, absolutely not, 65% of the Georgians told us. Five people on death row are juveniles on death row in Georgia right now. And then the third one, the big one, okay, what if we offered you a mandatory sentence of 25 years with restitution to the victim's family? And 52% of the citizens polled said they would be for that. And what that tells me, Terry, is that the opposition to the death penalty in this country is really quite significant. The support for it is a mile wide and an inch deep. Because when people come to understand that we're killing the retarded, that we're killing children, and we're not being any safer because, you know, there's no way the death penalty is a deterrent, that what we need is a mandatory sentence to satisfy people's legitimate needs for security. No one wants to be threatened or have members of their family hurt. So you have to have mandatory sentences for people to do significant lengths of time for murder. But they should also make restitutions to the victim's family. And I think that's what most Americans actually would like to see in regards to the death penalty. Now, we've got a problem because all our politicians want to lead us in the opposite direction, but I think eventually we'll get their attention.
Is there anything that you do really differently now when you enter prison than you did when you were younger and getting started?
Yeah, I have a very difficult time entering a prison if it's the same prison I was in recently when one of my friends was executed, one of my friends was slaughtered by the state. I have a very difficult time going back to that prison. As a matter of fact, a letter I got today was from a man whom I've known for years on Florida's death row who wants me to be with him this fall when he's going to be killed. And I just wept when I read it because I don't know if I can do it. I don't know if I can go back to that place. I've lost too many friends who've been strapped in that Florida electric chair. So I just don't know if I'll be able to go back and be with him. And I'll write him and tell him that, and I'll go and visit him here in a little while, and we'll talk about it, and we'll just see. So, you know, there's a real cost to all this, and I think it's called the cost of discipleship. I think that's what Dietrich Bonhoeffer called it.
Well, Joseph Engel, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
And my guest has been Joseph Engel, and he ministers to inmates on death row. He's written a new book about that called Last Rites. He's also the director of the Southern Coalition on Jails and Prisons. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.